Yeah. All right, clock. I'll do what you say. I'm supposed to be talking now, so I guess I'll start talking. I never can seem to get all my reading done. I'm reading Manufactured Crisis about the Israeli political origins of the nuclear scare. Well, there's American political origins, and there are Israeli political origins, and there are... Well, that's about it. Political origins, not scientific ones, of the Iranian nuclear scare. And so I was reading that's Gareth Porter's book. He's going to be back on the show today to continue our series of interviews on the subject of the so-called conflict over Iran's nuclear weapons. Come on. It's just an excuse for regime change at worst and long-term Cold War at best. As much as I hate the president, I do want to try to give him credit, even though it's only partial credit so far, for working as hard as he has worked to get the nuclear deal done. They got a pretty good half a deal now, and it's working out for everyone, and they're on their way to the final deal, which... Again, since it's a big fake manufactured crisis in the first place, that ought to be easy enough to resolve whatever outstanding issues. You just keep proving you're not making nukes, I don't know, extra. And we'll lift the sanctions and stop being enemies. How about that? Or at least start stopping being enemies. Something. The outlines of the deal are obvious. I think there's a pretty damn good chance that they're going to get it done. I think when Obama says, oh, I don't know, might work, might not, that he's just trying to stave off the right wing. I think he means to do this thing. I could be wrong about that. And that doesn't mean it'll necessarily get done, but I do think the president means to have a nuclear deal with Iran. And then that would be great. Because that's the last real outstanding issue, the last fake but important outstanding issue, really, between our countries, preventing normal... positive relations between the United States and Iran. I mean, what else you got? Support for Hamas and Hezbollah? Nah. You know what? We can be friends with them and negotiate that. That's not a big deal. Or not even friends, but, you know, we could end this Cold War and all this enmity. It's not necessary. If Nixon can have detente with the USSR, then certainly America can get along with the Iranians. Under Barack Obama and the Ayatollah Khomeini. After all, Khomeini, the really scary guy with the real dark circles around his eyes, he's dead and gone 25 years now, so. The new guy, he's not as scary. You know, in the poster. Seems like it could be done. And anyway, so Gareth's book is very well timed, Manufactured Crisis, completely undermining the case against Iran's nuclear program, the case for conflict with them about it. And anyway, I ain't done with it yet. I'm taking my time, and I'm taking a lot of notes. And then, basically, I just want to interview him as many times as it takes. It'll probably be, you know, I don't know, what, 6 or 9 interviews or something? I don't want to go on more than 6 or 7, really. I'll try to wrap it up. I'll try to combine chapters together into interviews as best as I can. 7 or 8, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, it's been 2 interviews so far. Today will be the 3rd on Manufactured Crisis with Gareth Porter. Since it's not about the atoms and the weapons, what is it all about, Gareth Porter? And, you know, I kind of started interview number 1 like that, but we're going to get really into the nitty-gritty on that today with Gareth, so that'll be great. And then... don't you think that's a good idea? To interview Gareth about every aspect of his book? I mean, I could just do 1 interview, like a radio show, and just say, hey, it's a radio show, there's a book, go read it. But I'd rather, you know, solve all of this. And plus, I'm learning all of these great things. Like, for example, did you see my awesome tweets last night? I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but... about Norman Schwarzkopf saying, you know, we ought to erase or, you know, forget about our old CENTCOM war plan, which is based around the fantasy that it would ever be necessary to keep the USSR from invading Iran. And since that's not likely to happen, especially with, you know, the fall of the wall and all of this, we need a new war plan, you know, so that CENTCOM can have an excuse to exist. The most plausible enemy, Norman Schwarzkopf wrote, would be Iraq. And they changed their kind of their base template for what kind of war might we expect to fight in the Middle East to, get this, keeping Iraq out of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. That was in 1989, a year before they baited Saddam. And, you know, Gareth doesn't get into the April Glaspie memo and all that stuff because he doesn't really need to in the book. But man, oh man, come on. Come on. Anyway, it's just like Kissinger said, it was that great quote, thanks to Fitzy G, got it for me last week, right? To be enemies of America is dangerous, but to be a friend is fatal. So, Saddam, you did a great job gassing Iranians and Kurds to death, and now it's time for the knife in your back. In case you forgot whose pleasure you were serving at. Man, oh man. So, anyway, Gareth Porter, he will be on the show. And also, coming up in just a quarter hour here or so, no, that's not right. A little longer than that. We'll be trying again to talk with Ambassador Jack Matlock. I got him on the phone this morning, so it should work. I don't know what the hell happened yesterday. His phone never rang, but it rang and rang from this end. Maybe the National Security Agency, like in the Snowden revelations, was interfering with my attempt to interview the ambassador. And more likely his cell phone gets crappy coverage and just didn't ring. That happens sometimes. Maybe he has AT&T. Anyway, Jack Matlock, you know, he really should have stayed on as ambassador a little bit longer than he would have been the last ambassador to the USSR. It says on his Wikipedia page that he resigned just 3 months, or a few months, which means three or four, right? So I guess the fall of 1991, just a few months before Gorbachev resigned and the USSR ceased to exist. So I don't know if they ever did really replace him. There was probably just an acting ambassador while they were working on getting a new guy in there or whatever, I don't know. But he was damn near, Jack F. Matlock was damn near the last ambassador to the Soviet Union. Did I just say Russia when I meant Soviet Union? I don't think I did. I was trying to discriminate correctly, but I might have spaced out. That happens a lot. You see people on TV, it's not just me. A lot of people do that. Guests on this show, a lot of the times. It's hard to remember that the USSR is gone for some reason, even though it's been 25 years. Since right around the time the Ayatollah died. Anyway, he's going to be on the show because he's been writing sensical things about America's Ukraine policy. And so I want to give him a chance to talk about it on the show. He's got interesting background and history. His article, he's got a few articles at jackmatlock.com. Yeah, Matlock, like Matlock. JackMatlock.com. He's got a few articles about Ukraine, going back here, talking about history and all that. And then he's got one here at the Washington Post called "The U.S. Has Treated Russia Like a Loser Since the End of the Cold War," which is very important. And he talks about how the end of the Cold War happened and then the fall of the Soviet Union and this and that. And then America's policies since then. Oh, I just remembered a note that I want to take. That I thought of while I was away from my notepad, and it was going to be about NATO and Lockheed. Where's my NATO expansion? Yeah, Lockheed. Well, I don't necessarily want to lead the witness and say Lockheed, but I want to ask him, why the NATO expansion? Of course, a big part of the answer is Lockheed. You know, making money off of your taxes, like that Steve Miller song. And anyway, yeah, so that'd be... Oh, I need, yeah. That's a hell of a way to waste a quarter of an hour on a radio show there, Scott Horton, just talking about what's going to happen on it. But I'll tell you what else is going to happen on it. Brand new Ed Snowden. If you didn't already see, it's going to tell you what you already knew, only really bad. Coming up in just a second. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Well, you know, I guess the ratings must just be doing great over at CNN this week. They've abandoned virtually every story in favor of this missing plane. You know what? Sometimes planes go missing, guys. It's probably at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. And you know how hard it can be to find missing things at the bottom of oceans. No, I ain't 100% on that, but I'm not obsessed with it either. Maybe they'll find it. Maybe they won't. What new information does CNN have? Nothing. They haven't had any new information this whole time. They just keep saying the same thing over and over again, and it'll say breaking at the bottom, and then they say the same damn things again. So maybe they hijacked it to Turkmenistan, some secret airstrip, or maybe it's at the bottom of the ocean. Let us know when you find out something. Otherwise, I don't know. You know what? It's best that they just leave the news to actual journalists, you know? Barton Gellman is over at the Washington Post today with some new Snowden documents, new Snowden revelations. NSA surveillance program reaches, quote, into the past to retrieve, replay phone calls. Into the past. They're recording phone calls. I'm not sure why all the reach into the past stuff. There's nothing magical about it. Mystic is the name of the program. It's got a big wizard on the slides and this and that. The briefing memo from inside the NSA that Edward Snowden liberated for us there. Call it mass collection interception. They're recording the phone calls. And the Washington Post does not say, and I suppose they've censored it from the documents they've released. But at least in the case of one sovereign nation state somewhere, the National Security Agency has obtained the ability to record every phone call, all of them, and keep them. Not just intercept every phone call and, you know, somehow try to filter it for keywords as the rest of it just gets deleted. But no, they're saving it. Everything. They're calling it retro and mystic. And what it says here is, some of the documents provided by Snowden suggest the high-volume eavesdropping may soon be extended to other countries, if it has not been already. The retro tool was built 3 years ago as a, quote, unique one-off capability. But last year's secret intelligence budget named five more countries for which the Mystic program provides, quote, comprehensive metadata access and content, with a sixth expected to be in place by last October. The budget did not say whether the NSA now records calls in quantity in those countries or expects to do so. A separate document placing high priority on planning for, quote, mystic accesses against projected new mission requirements, including voice. So, let's see. Ubiquitous voice surveillance, even overseas, pulls in a great deal of content from Americans who telephone, visit, and work in the target country. It may also be seen as inconsistent with Obama's January 17th pledge, quote, that the United States is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security, regardless of nationality, and that we take their privacy concerns into account. What a laugh. So, now, this does not prove that they're recording every phone call on Earth, only that they would like to and that they're able to target some countries. So pick your highest priority countries. Germany. When it comes to economic interests, right? The leaders of the EU. Or Iran, where there's a big fake scare about their nuclear program. Or, say, Yemen or Pakistan, where they like targeting people with their remote control planes for assassination. That kind of thing. Yeah, I don't know. Nobody knows. Washington Post ain't saying. They say that they have a buffer. They can save this stuff for a month, and then they've got to get rid of it. And now here's my thing. This is my guess all along. Isn't this what I've told you guys all along? That audio file is just a digital file, the same as a Word document. You can record human voices at very low quality and still get, you know, have it plenty good enough to tell what people are saying, especially for a computer to analyze what people are saying or for others to listen to it. You know, I don't know. You can go as low as, who knows what, 1K maybe if you have a certain kind of codec. I know 8K sounds pretty bad, but still fine. So how low can they go? They could probably record at really low quality. And then MP3, as was pointed out somewhere, I forget, that's 1992 technology or 1995 technology or something. There are all kinds of different codecs now. Certainly the government has codecs that emphasize saving space, and they can use to zip down audio files into as few digits as possible. It's not like they have to save everything in 256K stereo, MP3 format, or WAV format, or some giant thing. And what's a phone call? Most phone calls don't even last that long in the first place. Most phone calls are, a few minutes. I guess it depends, but maybe less, maybe a few seconds. So anyway, and then they say, wow, well, for up to 30 days, whenever we find a new subject we want to inquire about, we can now go back in time 30 days and look at their whole life, you know, what's been going on, all their metadata and the actual audio of their phone calls going back 30 days. And, you know, I don't know. Once they actually get it worked out where it really works, then what's the problem with replicating it, right? It's just implementing the software on that many different computers in Utah, assembling that many hard drives in a row to save it. And then, you know, the taxpayers got you on that. They can afford an endless number of disks to spin. And boy, they sure seem to have the room for them. So why not? And this is the direction we're going. And you know, I don't know, man. It seems like we do have an opportunity to roll this stuff back if we work really hard. But it's a very short window of time before people just start getting used to it. And then it's too late and there's nothing we can do. This is what Neil Postman meant by technopoly. The complete surrender of technology and the complete surrender of culture and humanity to technology. Whatever can be invented will be invented and will be implemented as soon as it's affordable to implement. And so, total information awareness? Hell yeah. as much as they can possibly be aware of. What's the limit on it other than old law that nobody cares to enforce? You know, like the Fourth Amendment that says that no matter what you can do, you may not. I mean, you got to look at the fact, too. And I'm sorry, if you're a Democrat, close your ears because I don't want to give you any damned ideas. But one of the most terrible problems in our society is men beating their wives and to death. I mean, this is the source of most violence other than our government, you know, mass murdering Iraqis for sport and all that. But when it comes to, like, who is assaulting who, it's husbands and boyfriends beating on their women. That's most, isn't it? That's much of the violence in society. It doesn't matter if it's most or not for this hypothetical anyway. So the solution, obviously, is to just put cameras in everybody's houses. Or, okay, maybe that's too intrusive. How about sensors that start recording and transmitting if they pick up the sound of a woman's scream? And then every cop, you see how easy it is to come up with this crap? I just come up with this right now off the top of my head. That'll be step one. Camera second. But from now on, if a woman screams in anybody's house, boop, 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 cops come to make sure everything's okay. How about that? The technology is there. Now, for as an unfunded mandate, maybe they need to get, you know, a little bit cheaper before they can just pass these things out and make it mandatory. And maybe they'd have to put some, you know, the more you know commercials on TV to get you used to the idea for a little while first. But what argument could you have against protecting women from being beaten within an inch of their life or worse? When that's some of the, certainly it's more of a threat to the civilian population of this society than terrorism is. And look at what we're willing to give up for that. And you see what happens when you don't have any firm principles, even, you know, something like the Fourth Amendment, the First, the Fifth, the Eighth, to protect us from, you know, because they can't protect us. If people believe in them and insist that they really are the law, then things will be that way. But you gotta, well, you can't believe that they are. You gotta make sure. You know, eternal vigilance and this and that. Without that Bill of Rights, what's our government other than just a gigantic taxpayer-funded and inflation-funded, which means unlimited budgets, behind a world empire and a domestic one too, a police state for us, with all the high-tech systems of slavery that they invented for the Fallujans, just scan your iris here in order to pass through the checkpoint, coming home for all of us. What in the world is preventing them from recording every phone call in America? If they can do it for a month, why can't they do it for a year or for five? Just another couple of years worth of Moore's Law, right? And who's going to stop them? Us?
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.
On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And did you see this where, well, a little background. Of course, the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by Dianne Feinstein, senator from California. Go ahead and spit if you're outside. I'll wait a second for you. Her staff has written up a 6,300-page-long report about CIA torture. And The thing of it is, in order to even write up that report, they had to agree. They didn't have to, but they did agree with the CIA demand that the staffers could only look through the CIA's records at computers at CIA headquarters. And then they broke into those computers repeatedly. And Feinstein kept complaining about it. And they kept not apologizing and doing it anyway. I think at one point they said they would stop. But then, at least according to Feinstein, her staff came upon what's called the Panetta Review, which is an internal CIA review of the torture program ordered by the former director, Leon Panetta, which actually pretty much backs up, according to Feinstein, backs up the Senate report's version of the truth, where the CIA is trying to claim that, they've got everything all wrong and all their facts are wrong and why we gotta dispute 10,000 little facts, you know, as though we can't tell that they're just running interference. But here they found an internal CIA report that backs up what they said. And according to Feinstein, her people just came across the thing. They didn't know whether the CIA had deliberately given it to them, had accidentally given it to them, whether a whistleblower inside the CIA had made sure that this was among the documents. But for some reason, it's in there. Now, of course, Dianne Feinstein and her committee have every right to any CIA document they want. And the CIA has absolutely no right whatsoever to refuse them, period. They have the right to say, ma'am, yes ma'am, or resign. And those are their two choices. And that's it. Now, they want to quibble and say that, well, they have agreements with the Senate about how this is to be done and what have you. The Senate should have never agreed to that. But any place where the Senate goes outside that agreement, tough. They are the Senate. The Congress created the CIA with the National Security Act of 1947. And with the whatever reforms in 1978 and 79, they created these committees. And they have the oversight. They have the authority. If they wanted to change the law to give themselves even more authority, they could do that too. And if they wanted to impeach and remove the director of the CIA, they could do that too. And any other executive officer. But what happened was, and this is what finally drove Feinstein to complain publicly. Not that they were spying on her, but that where CIA, it wasn't she who referred the CIA to the Justice Department. It was the CIA Inspector General that, filed notice with the Justice Department that they ought to do a criminal investigation of the CIA officers who broke into these Senate committee computers. Can you believe that? The CIA Inspector General did that. Not that Eric Holder's going to do anything about it. Give me a break. But that's kind of something, isn't it? Sort of. Anyway. But that wasn't it. What got her mad was there's a CIA lawyer who is one of their high-level torture lawyers who's now the lawyer for the CIA, the top lawyer for the CIA. And he went and basically filed a criminal complaint. I don't know the exact jargon for it, but he filed a criminal complaint against the Senate Intelligence Committee staff for taking the Panetta report and leaving CIA headquarters with it and taking it back to the Capitol Hill with them. And then at that point, Feinstein got pissed off because apparently somehow there's enough humanity in this person that she has a specific loyalty to her staff who were under threat. And she decided she would defend them. And so that's what caused Dianne Feinstein to go to the Senate floor and give this speech saying, hey, butt out. You're in violation of the constitutional separation of powers trying to get an investigation going here. You're trying to intimidate my staff and it's making me angry. You better stop it and apologize. And I think she just threw this in, or her speechwriters threw this in just to make everybody else giggle or to distract us all from the real torture fight going on here. And that was, she invoked, hilariously, she invoked Executive Order 12333 and the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which both presumably forbid American intelligence agencies from operating against Americans on American soil. Hardy, har, har, har. When she is, of course, the worst person in America on the NSA. She's the chair of the Senate committee that lets them get away with it all. She admits that, oh, 12333, no, I don't guess we ever do exercise oversight on that. Oh, yeah, that's the gigantic loophole they drive the entire NSA spying apparatus through, huh? No wonder you're only looking at Patriot 215 and FISA Amendment 702. Give me a break. Dianne Feinstein, scumbag. See, it distracted me too. Here's this massive fight where the CIA is trying to intimidate the most powerful Intelligence Committee senator. Not just some scumbag senator, the chair of the Intelligence Committee. The CIA is fighting back like they're her dad. Like they're the ones who are the boss of her. This ought to make every little R Republican's head explode. Any libertarian, liberal, or conservative, Republican, or Democrat who thinks that there ought to be anything like a constitutional rule of law that binds the authority of these people in power. The CIA has declared war against the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Oh, and of course, Obama's backing up John Brennan against Dianne Feinstein. This is historic. This is huge. And now here's, I tell you that whole setup. I should have tried harder to get Lande on the show today. Anyway, check this out. Here's Nancy Pelosi. Says, I salute, she's of course the former Speaker of the House, the ranking Democrat in the House of Representatives. She says, I salute Senator Feinstein. Yeah, 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 but wait. I'll tell you, you take on the intelligence community, you're a person of courage. And she does not do that lightly, not without evidence. And when I say evidence, documentation of what it is that she is putting forth. Now, you might think that she's saying, oh, because we worship our demigods in the intelligence agencies who protect us all and keep us safe. That could be the implication of the quote I just read. Hey, if you take on the intelligence community, you're a person of courage. She doesn't do it lightly, not without evidence. No, that's not what she's getting at. Here's what she's getting at. You ready? Quote Pelosi, you don't fight it, the intelligence community, without a price, because they come after you and they don't always tell the truth. Whatever else there is should be examined in terms of what happened and who let that happen as far as CIA spying on the Senate. This may be one of the healthiest things we can do, because I know one thing, whatever it is, the intelligence community writes a report on that. They leave. They write a book on it. All of a sudden, yeah, I don't know what the hell she's talking about anymore. It's Nancy Pelosi stops making sense after a little while. Yeah, and as far as the lies, this is the other important part of Dianne Feinstein's speech, is that her report documents, she claims, her claims that the CIA lied to Congress about what they were doing. All this stuff about, oh yeah, sometimes we give them an open hand slap on the tummy. And all of this kind of crap. That, no, that's not the torture program. The real torture program is in here. And it's not about open hand slaps. And it's not about dunking a couple of guys underwater a couple of times. And listen, it was Pelosi's fault. If anybody ever lied to her, it's her responsibility for accepting any false claim as true. She's got a responsibility to be better than a dupe. And if she's a dupe, and I think she is probably typically pretty good on torture, but if she's willing to be, if she's capable of being lied to on torture by the executive branch, that's 100% her fault as much as it's 100% theirs. That's what's funny about responsibility. Percents don't really apply. It's more a matter of quality than quantity, you see. And so all of the tortures and George Bush and Dick Cheney and John Ashcroft and all their lawyers and Dianne Feinstein, they're all responsible. She could have stopped it. You and me and all of us know that Dianne Feinstein could have stopped the torture before it even got going. She could have made it clear to George Bush that you can kill me, but otherwise you're going to have a massive fight in the U.S. Senate over torture. You're not doing this. And she didn't do that. She's guilty as hell. She wants to pretend like it's all their fault. I'm sure they lied to her. I'm sure it's true that they lied to the Congress about what they were really doing. But that doesn't really let Congress off the hook. That just makes them even more guilty. You know, I remember Ron Paul was opposing the war with Iraq, and he went on the Bill Moyers show on PBS, and Bill Moyers said, well, but Ron Paul, do you go to all these classified briefings and learn all about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction? And Ron Paul said, oh, no, I don't want to be confused by their propaganda. No, I don't go into the classified briefing to learn a bunch of lies. I'll get my news from the open source media and use my best judgment from there, and I'll give myself a better shot of being right that way, thanks. And of course that's correct, you know. Any of us just even reading the Post and the Times know better than what these senators and congressmen claim is the best of their information after the fact anyway. But anyway, yeah, so that's just the biggest deal in the world to me that, you know, she's not saying she's afraid. Pelosi's not saying she's afraid the CIA will kill her or whatever. But she's saying they will fight back against you. The intelligence community, I mean, we like it when they fight back against Bush, when Bush is trying to lie us into war with Iran and the CIA says no and puts out a report telling the truth that Iran's not making nukes like happened in 07. When Admiral Fallon says, over my dead body, will you have this war? That's cool. You know, but when they're going to war with Congress for doing the right thing and exercising oversight over their crimes, their felonies of torture and murder, got a real problem there, man. Way, way out of control.
Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, all Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first, and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org, or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Here in just a little while, we'll be talking with Jack Matlock, former ambassador to the Soviet Union, about the situation in Ukraine and Crimea and this and that and the rest. A little bit of history for you. I want to read this guy's book, man. It's called Reagan and Gorbachev, The End of the Cold War. Something like that. Well, I want to read a lot of things. I am in the middle of reading Manufactured Crisis by the great Gareth Porter, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare, and I'll be interviewing him part three of my interview of him about this book coming up on the show later on. Okay, now, our... I guess I want to bring this up real quick. Maybe this has been updated and I don't know yet. National Guardsman who allegedly plotted to bomb L.A. subway charged with attempting to aid Al-Qaeda. That makes me think that he was a dupe of an FBI agent. However, I will point out that NBC Los Angeles, their version of the story... they say confided to his source Someone was ratting on him, but his confidant, his source, his confidant. Was his confidant ever his friend? Or was it just an FBI informant sent out to entrap some idiot? Let's see, here's national NBC News. Actually, you know, NBC News, or at least on MSNBC's website, they're pretty good about updating their articles and keeping the same URL, you know? So let's see here if they say anything about undercover FBI. Confidential law enforcement source. Law enforcement source was the person that he was spilling his guts to. The confidential source. How can I get fireworks? Yeah, it'll be a real terrorist attack. The criminal complaint does not identify the other people that he allegedly discussed the purported plot with, nor does it detail whether the FBI found or interviewed those individuals. Toussaint has been charged with a single count of attempting to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. Right. In other words, another case of the FBI recruiting some idiot into saying that he wants to do something. Here, say into the mic, you love Osama. I'll give you $20,000 if you say you love Osama, you idiot. And then the idiot says it. And then, oh, a big orange alert. And oh boy, you know what? Wouldn't we all die without the government here to protect us? There have been more than 50 of these. More than 50. And I don't mean fake terrorist cases. That would be probably 300-400 by now. But I mean outright entrapment snow jobs, where they just find some idiot and offer to pay him some incredible amount of money to say something stupid. Ow, I bit my tongue. Into a microphone. About loving Osama and wanting to kill people. Did this guy work for Al-Qaeda? No. Did he have any access to explosives? No. Did he have any money? Did he have any plans? No. He just had somebody who he thought was his friend taunting him into talking big. So impressed. Aren't you impressed? Oh, a 20-year-old. Yeah. FBI agent successfully put stupid words in mouth of 20-year-old boy. Nation amazed. Anybody know anybody who writes for The Onion? Maybe they could come up with a funnier way to say that. And meanwhile, don't forget, every time that you have an actual attempted attack, like Abdulmutallab, like Faisal Shahzad, right, the Detroit and the Times Square bomber attacks, or Tamerlane and his brother in Boston, remember that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of FBI agents running around the country working diligently on entrapping some idiot into saying what a tough Osama-loving terrorist he is, while real people are getting killed and or are being put at substantial risk of being killed. So don't forget to blame the FBI every time something bad happens from now on. If they weren't busy entrapping some idiot so they can get themselves in the newspaper and get themselves a promotion to supervisor where they just get to sit around sucking tax blood directly out of the lives of the people at higher rates for less sweat. That terrible thing couldn't happen. It's their fault to prevent. How many new enemies do you think the U.S. government has created for you in the last few years? I know, right? A lot. Some of them are coming here. And when they do, the FBI will not be protecting you. They'll be busy protecting themselves and their own careers. It's the public choice theory of federal policing. They actually don't love you or care about you at all. They care only about themselves. And so if that means entrapping some idiot and letting a real terrorist blow up a little kid at a foot race, then they'll let that happen. They will let that happen right on their watch. Watch them. Right on our watch. Isn't that funny how after September 11th, the American people didn't fire and completely abolish the entire national government and start over again, or maybe not even that? The FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, the president, and all his men couldn't stop some hijackers from getting away with killing 3,000 people like that? Maybe we don't need them at all. Maybe if it wasn't for the CIA and the Pentagon and the presidency, we wouldn't have these terrorist problems in the first place. Instead, what happens? Well, we only have one security force to turn to. The same guys who just let us down. They'll know what to do. Now that this happened on their watch. And so we're stuck. I mean, you would think, especially at the FBI. And this is the kind of thing where you can get economists to talk about this, right? This isn't conspiracy theory conjecture. This isn't libertarianism. This is just, you know, kind of academic talk among reasonable men with patches on their elbows. And, you know, fancy letters after their names that, you know, institutions sometimes don't work well and become dysfunctional. Is it possible that the FBI is the single greatest example of that in history? And is it possible? Is it not possible to just fire the FBI and everyone at the FBI? If you're to have any kind of federal police force at all, might you not want to start and make a new one? You know, I remember Peter Lance, who wrote all about how 9/11 happened on the FBI's watch. He was for the Department of Homeland Security, and he had a hardcore libertarian instinct against it. He said, I don't want a new national police force, man. I don't want to have a Department of Homeland Security. But you know what? The FBI is just not going to protect us, man. These guys are the worst Al-Qaeda stopping asses in the whole hemisphere, and they always will be. And they'll never be better. And if we have to create a whole new agency just with the purpose of, you know, trying to keep Al-Qaeda out, then I say we do it, man. Hell, we just can't leave it up to these goons at the J. Edgar Hoover building. Now, how honest and accurate is that? How true does that ring to you? You know, not that you necessarily really agree with him that we want Homeland Security, but that the FBI, they're just no good. They're too busy entrapping some 20-year-old idiot into saying he loves Osama to protect a little kid from getting blown up at a marathon. It's disgusting, isn't it? You're supposed to love these guys? You're supposed to imagine that all of them are likable, like Mulder on that show with the Scully, and she was pretty, and they seem to really care about people. You know, I'll tell you a funny anecdote one time, about one time. Frederick Whitehurst, he was the FBI whistleblower from their crime lab. Remember him in the 1980s? And he said that they manufactured fake evidence and lied in the cases of Waco, Oklahoma City, and the first World Trade Center bombing, I believe. He definitely said they were just making up their info evidence at Oklahoma City. But anyway, he was a crime lab whistleblower. And I interviewed him on the show back years ago. And I actually talked with him off the air one time. And I'm pretty sure this was not in confidence. I can repeat this. It was all just kind of hypothetical anyway. We were talking about Oklahoma and how people got away with that. And he was saying for FBI agent, a good one, to go to his boss and get authority to follow important leads on a case like that is unheard of. If they do what their agent suggests at all, they'll give it to somebody else. It just is not like on TV. It never is, and it never works. It's just a dysfunctional society there.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you.
Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/scotthortonshow as well, if you want. Our first guest on the show today is former Ambassador Jack Matlock. He's a career diplomat, according to Wikipedia. Anyway, spent an entire career from the Kennedy administration on dealing with the Soviets, and was at least virtually the last ambassador to the USSR. I'm not certain about that. Welcome back to, welcome to the show, Jack. How are you doing?
Oh, glad to be with you.
Very happy to have you here. And I think I read at Wikipedia it said that you finally retired from the Foreign Service just a few months before Gorbachev resigned and the USSR finally dissolved on Christmas Day in 1991. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. Yes, I retired in 1991, so it's been a few years.
Yeah. And now, so were you in fact the last ambassador? Did they get someone in there before the USSR was gone?
Robert Strauss replaced me, and so he was ambassador to the Soviet Union for about 2.5-3 months before it collapsed.
Ah, you should have hung in there a couple more months.
Ambassador.
All right. Well, anyway, so listen, everyone, you should know jackmatlock.com is the website. He's the author of the books Superpower Illusions, Autopsy on an Empire, and Reagan and Gorbachev, How the Cold War Ended. And he's also got a blog there, basically a lot of very interesting articles, especially lately about Ukraine. And then this one is all important. You may have seen it in the Washington Post. It's entitled, "The U.S. Has Treated Russia Like a Loser Since the End of the Cold War," attempting to provide some necessary historical context for the current conflict. And I guess if we could really start there, I would ask you about, it seems like you and Paul Pillar and Leslie Gelb and other people who are, you know, pretty official from the foreign policy establishment have really been put in the position of complaining that we're not even basing our policy on an accurate narrative of events, of what's even gone on here. I think Gelb in the Daily Beast complained the most about it, that we're living kind of in an unreality here about just what is taking place in Ukraine, and then we're making apparently bad decisions based on the false narrative. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, there's a lot to that. I would say specifically, you know, during the Reagan and the first Bush administrations, we started with the Cold War at its very height. And it was President Reagan who decided that, look, you know, we really got to bring an end to this, but he understood he had to do two things. One thing, he had to make sure we were strong enough to negotiate. In other words, that he could tell the Soviet leader, let's stop this arms race. If we don't, we're going to win it. And but the reason he did that was he wanted to negotiate. And he also understood that to negotiate, you had to find ways to give the other fellow incentive for doing what you need to do. And that means you got to define your aim as one that is not really harmful to them. Now, at the top of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was following policies that were not in their interest. You know, they were supporting revolutions elsewhere in the world. They were ruining their economy with arms things, and they had a lousy economy to begin with. But they were actually doing things that were not in their interest. And so Reagan was able, even before Gorbachev came to power, to define our interests in a way that we could both win. And he, instead of saying, you've got to improve your human rights, he said, let's find a way to cooperate to improve human rights. He also said another thing to us on the staff before he first met Gorbachev. He said, we're too upfront on this human rights. If we, and I'm using his words, if we take it public, we'll get a lot of cheers from the bleachers, but we're going to hurt those we want to help. We've got to go private, and we can't make the other person think he's doing us a favor to, you know, do the right thing by his own people. And that's what he did. We did it step by step. On everything else, we said we need to cooperate to reduce arms. We're both spending too much. Well, we knew it was hurting them more than us, but we were both spending too much. And most of all, of course, Reagan did not like nuclear weapons. He didn't talk about that an awful lot, but he was really basically an abolitionist. I think he knew in his heart, if we were attacked, he couldn't bring himself to kill millions of other people just in retaliation. And he would say, you know, this mutual assured destruction, this is unacceptable. In other words, I won't go on and on. I've done all this in my books. But we began to find a way to shift into a private dialogue these difficult issues. And this got to the point, once we began to build trust, and particularly with Gorbachev, who understood that the country couldn't go on like it was, it needed to change, then we helped him change by often not going public with a lot of very emotional issues. And I go into some of that in my book. But the point was that you don't just beat up on them without giving them a way out. And if it's a real emotional issue, you handle it privately. And you try to handle it in a way that the other guy's got something to gain, too. And the thing is, we ended the Cold War, and we ended it a couple of years before the Soviet Union collapsed. We ended it in a way that we both won. We won the Cold War, but they did too. Because what did they get? They got an end to the arms race that was ruining them. They got an end to the foreign pressure that was helping to sustain a totalitarian system there. It gave Gorbachev a chance to try to reform it, and so on. It was an end to the domination of Eastern Europe, which was a drain to them at the time. So, yeah. We all won the Cold War, and we won it by negotiation. And then after that, the Soviet Union collapsed of its own accord from internal pressures. And actually, the Russians, leaders at that time, helped us in the Cold War and actually led the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, they thought they were going to be accepted. They threw off communism. And they thought that suddenly, you know, they're going to be accepted as partners. And in fact, many people thought, now that we don't have communism, we'll soon be living like Americans. And they ended up in the 90s with chaos. And increasingly, the United States, rather than treating Russia as, you know, a potential partner, we start doing all sorts of things that the Russians look at as hostile. And so now, here it is, 22 years later, We have a situation where our president and their president, the chemistry is so bad that we really can't have these heart-to-heart, discussions that, and privately the way we used to work these things out. As a matter of fact, Putin is using our criticism, much of which is quite valid, but it's done publicly. He's using it at home, and he got tremendous applause today when he took Crimea, back into Russia. All Russians have always considered that rightfully part of Russia. And so he's very, he's increased his popularity and because of the tension with us. So I think we should bear these things in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. People keep wondering, I keep seeing people wonder why the Americans have done it the way they've done it, because it seems so obvious that if they push the Russians too far on an issue like Ukraine, they might just lose the Crimean Peninsula, for one thing, for one example, and maybe, they're at least risking losing the eastern half of Ukraine if it really came to that, possibly. And it seems so predictable that people assume, well, so what is it that they're really after? You know what I mean? If it's not this, is it really just that they're that inept when it comes to threatening Russia's interests, that they're so one-sided in their view they can't even predict something like maybe they won't tolerate a second Orange Revolution, a second putsch and regime change in Ukraine?
Well, I really can't speak for them now. I think that, the biggest damage was done during the George W. Bush administration. That 8 years, pulling out of the ABM treaty when we really didn't have to, continuing to expand NATO, and not only expanding NATO, but moving bases there and talking about them. All that stuff started then, and then it was that administration that started about talking about taking Ukraine into NATO at a time when two-thirds of the Ukrainians didn't want to be in NATO. Now, why the United States would want to take on, a guarantee for the protection of a country which was divided, had not, solved its internal problems, and two-thirds of its people didn't want to be protected by the United States, I don't know. It just didn't seem to have any rationality at all. But it was part of the psychology that you get, and, this psychology is not a matter of whether it's left or right. You get some people that think they're liberal, and there are others that say they're conservative, and they both think this way. The idea that we're so powerful that we can, we're the only superpower now that the Cold War was over, and therefore we can remake the world in our image. Well, we are the most powerful country in military, and we can destroy any other country we wish. But, we don't have the power to reform them, and our form of government is not necessarily the one that is best for them. In any case, of course, we would like people to have democracy and prosperous economies and, and respect rights, but this is something they have to create for themselves. And as we learned in Iraq, You can, remove the dictator and so on, and yet you can't put in place something that is going to last, that is right for them. They have to do that. And frankly, I just feel sorry for, almost 5,000 Americans lost their lives in Iraq. For what? And, how many thousands have their lives maimed forever? And we taxpayers are stuck with something that may run close to $1 trillion because of that war. And this was one that not only the Russians, but also our friends the French and the Germans told us, don't do it. Don't do it. Not only is it illegal to do it without UN approval, and we didn't have it, but you don't have sufficient cause. So, this is one that, as I said, a particular administration did it, but there is, unfortunately, there are people in both of our parties that seem to think it's our duty to remake the world or to police it, even if we can't remake it. And I just don't think we can do that. I don't think the American people want to. And so I think that's what's behind it. Now, in the case of the Obama administration, his motivation, I think, is different from Bush's. We had had 9/11, and, you know, Bush was saying, well, we have to go after, you know, the perpetrators, and that we did, except that Iraq wasn't one of the perpetrators. But now it's a matter of humanitarian intervention. The idea that, you know, if people are suffering in another country and their government is going after them, we have to do something to protect them. Now, you know, I think there's something to that. And I would say that, you know, I think that we need an international structure of, you know, of volunteers that with international approval, UN approval, can go into countries and do that. But I don't think that's something that is a duty of the United States. And when we try to do it alone or just insist that others come along with us and we take the lead, others think that we're just doing it for imperialistic purposes. And I'm sure, you know, the people that argue that, often they have no real military experience, and they mean well. But, you know, if we take Syria today, you know, there's no way we can keep the government from killing its own people without putting our people there and getting shot at. And even then, what are we going to get if we take out the Syrian government? You could get something worse. I sympathize with people that say, you know, something ought to be done, but I would say, look, let's be realistic about what we can do and can't do, and for goodness sakes, don't get our people involved in other people's disputes. We should have more respect for our young people in the military than to put them in, you know, in the crossfire of other people. And I'm afraid that's what there's been a tendency to do. And that's not a partisan thing, because you find both Republicans and Democrats that follow that logic.
Mm-hmm. All right, now I want to get back to the current situation in Crimea and some of the background history too here. First of all, apparently, I've read it reported, I haven't read the book, but it's been reported that in Robert Gates' memoirs, his new book, Duty, that has come out, that he recounts that at the fall of the Soviet Union, Dick Cheney, who was George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Defense at the time, that he wanted to, he doesn't specify, I don't think, not quite Patton, like rolling tanks all the way to Moscow, but he wanted to dismember Russia, not just the Soviet Union. Dick Cheney wanted to break Russia into as many pieces as he possibly could. And I wonder whether this is really just that same Cheneyite, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby strategy from 1991 playing itself out, maybe kind of in slow motion, but it's that, you know, never mind good sportsmanship, we're going to take Russia apart. It'll never be anything like the Soviet Union ever again.
Yeah, well, I can't testify that that was his idea. I mean, Gates would know, presumably. You know, it's a thoroughly bad idea. You know, there was also, during World War II, there was the idea we should take Germany apart so it could never be a threat again. Well, you know, that really wasn't, you were not going to be able to keep the Germans apart necessarily. And when you tried, you would get into all sorts of problems. So what we did instead, and I think rightly so, was to set up NATO, which was not only set up in order to protect us from the Soviet Union or to protect Europe, but in order to keep the Germans under control, to let them rearm. And then later, when they united the two German states, let them be in the integrated NATO alliance and not sort of an independent actor that could start pushing their weight around too much in Europe. And I think that was very wise, and that's one of the reasons we needed to keep NATO even when the Cold War was over. But the idea that you're going to break up Russia, Russia is, in many ways, a wonderful country with wonderful people. They have had a series of terrible governments, some worse than others. But they're survivors. And you know, you can't have better allies. And it's not a good idea that, you know, to make enemies of them. I think that the idea that somehow just being Russia was creating a problem is absolutely wrong. You know, when you look at World War II, well, you know, it was Germany that invaded Russia. During the Napoleonic times, it was Napoleon and the French. They've been invaded many times. And I'll tell you, you know, in most of these wars, we and Russia were on the same side. When you think about it, Russia is the only big country that we have never had a war with. Maybe France also, but, you know, there have been skirmishes there. And that should tell us something about we don't really have any strong conflicting national interests.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, I want to ask you, too, about this Reuters piece says that Lavrov and Kerry agree to work on constitutional reform in Ukraine. In other words, stronger federalism, less power for the central government. Is that
right?
Is that basically just code for America backing down finally like they never should have stood up in the first place?
I don't know what the extent it's backing down, because I don't know what our position was before, but I think it's a good thing. I think it's just logical that with all the differences in Ukraine, the different people, they need a federal system. One of their problems has been that they had a centralized government, and you had groups that would win an election by 51%, and then it'd be winner take all. The president appointing all the governors and whatnot, even though only slightly more than half the people had voted for him, and almost nobody in some of those areas. So, yeah, I think they need a constitution that gives their provinces at least as much independence as our states have. You know, federalism works in the United States, and we argue about it a lot, but basically it works. And I think that should be a no-brainer. And if we stood against it before, we were simply wrong. And it's good that we are changing our mind.
Yeah. Well, now, it seems to me, and I'm sure you've considered this too, that America's relationship with Russia is really the most important thing in the history of all of humanity. I mean, the Chinese have a few dozen nukes, and I guess it could come down to a war between us and Britain or France someday in some indeterminate future. But the real risk to mankind, even Pakistan and India have limited nuclear arsenals. The real risk to the future of civilization is America and Russia's arsenals of H-bombs. And it seems like people just forget about it. They think that the nukes disappeared when the Cold War disappeared or something. It's the lowest list, the lowest on the list of priorities for the Americans, it seems. But I can't think of anything more important than America and Russia staying on good terms no matter what, especially when, like Pat Buchanan said on the show last week, the communist ideology is over. We're not having to worry about that anymore. This is just Russia, and we can deal with Russia.
Pat is absolutely right about that. And he's been right about a lot of things recently. You know, that's right. We have about the same number of nuclear weapons, too many in both cases, and we still need to work on, you know, bringing them down. But you're absolutely right, you know. People are talking about, oh, you know, there used to be two superpowers. Now there's only one, the United States. I say, now, wait a minute. What makes you a superpower? Is it nuclear weapons? Well, I'll tell you one thing. There is no rational military use for nuclear weapons, number one. And number two, it would be crazy to use them, particularly against another country that has them. Number three, they can destroy, but they can't build anything. And therefore, you know, national power really should be measured in other ways. But as long as we have them, we have to make darn sure they're not used. You know, I get a little worried when I hear all this, you know, all options are on the table. you know, when we're talking about Iran or some of the other things.
Right.
And they mean also military action. I'll tell you, to end the Cold War, the first thing in their first meeting that Reagan and Gorbachev did was take the option of war off the table. They both agreed to a statement which had originated by Reagan saying a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought, and that means there can be no war between us. Now, you know, so you start by both sides taking that completely off the table, and that's the only rational thing to do. Now, you know, but the idea of treating Russia, I know at one point one of my friends, General Odom, unfortunately not with us anymore, mm-hmm. but, you know, he was making statements in the 90s, well, Russia is upper volta with nukes. Now, that's ridiculous. But that sort of disrespect, sure, they had a system that was more like anarchy, and everybody, most everybody was suffering from the transition. But the fact was that, you know, it is a large country, enormous resources, and particularly the human resources, well-trained people, brilliant scientists, and so on. As I said, they have suffered from lousy government, that's true. And I think, you know, in time, they're going to correct some of that. But this idea of thinking that they were enemies or had to be is just wrong. I put it a different way. I say, you know, we face a lot of international issues today. Terrorism, deterioration of the environment, spread of disease. You know, these are threats that don't come necessarily from countries, but they are general and they threaten us all. Now, in solving those, Russia is either going to be part of the solution or part of the problem. And, you know, when we just pick fights with them, as we seem to be doing now, we're making them part of the problem. And it's part of the, instead of part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And I do think that we have to understand that, you know, whether we like what another leader is doing in his country or not, it's really not our business to try to teach them democracy. I mean, they'll find their way to a system. Many of them want to improve theirs now. But they can do it much better if we are, you know, somewhat understanding and particularly respectful.
Right.
You know,
I'm sorry, Ambassador. I'm sorry. I just have to interrupt you. We're over time, and we have to go to our next guest. But I want to thank you so much for your time on the show today. I really appreciate
it.
I hope we can do it again. All right, everybody. That is Jack F. Matlock. His website is jackmatlock.com. He was almost the last ambassador to the Soviet Union, and he's got this piece in the Washington Post, "The U.S. has treated Russia like a loser since the end of the Cold War," and many more good articles at jackmatlock.com. Please check that out, and we're over time, but we'll be right back with Gareth Porter in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. I got Gareth on the line here. We went a little bit over time with our last guest. He's good. I like that guy. Jack Matlock, former American ambassador to the Soviet Union. JackMatlock.com. Check him out. All right, now, Gareth Porter, his website is ipsnews.net. Well, that's where he writes. He's a reporter for them, Interpress Service. IPSnews.net, and also you can find what he writes at truthout.org a hell of a lot of the time. And he wrote a great book about Vietnam called Perils of Dominance, and the brand newest one is Manufactured Crisis, the Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And so this will be part three of our interview series about the new book. Welcome back to the show. Gareth, how the hell are you?
I'm fine. Thanks again, Scott. I'm so
glad that you're paying so much attention to my book. That's very great of you.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I want to know this stuff, and you're the best. So, you know, yeah, I love it. And I'm learning so much. It's just great. You know, hopefully we'll get into some of Chapter 5, but there's so much just on Chapter 4 to cover. I think we might only get through Chapter 4 on the show today here. The U.S. political origins of the nuke scare. Kind of like I asked you at the beginning of this for the KPFK show on Sunday. You know, what's it all about if it ain't about a fake nuclear weapons program that doesn't exist and never existed and that they've known all along, or at least had a great reason to believe all along doesn't exist? What's it all about? And that's Chapter 4 here, the U.S. political origins of the Iran nuke scare. And so there, what's it all about? Tell me.
Well, you know, that, what I cover in that chapter about political origins of the Iran nuclear scare is the sort of dual origins of this crisis. And one of the origins is what people are, I think, quite familiar with, and that is the influence of Israel on U.S. policy toward Iran. I mean, it has been a very profound influence ever since the beginning of the 1990s. You know, there was some influence before that, but I have to say that during the Reagan administration, it was far less than it was during the Clinton administration. It was really the Clinton administration that introduced a very profound Israeli influence on U.S. policy in the Middle East, and that was nowhere more deeply felt than on policy toward Iran. So that's pretty well known, but I go into, I think, more depth in providing a history of how that came about and what the consequences were, more than other sources. And the second part of this, which I think is really unknown to almost everyone else, is the way in which the bureaucratic interests of the national security state, particularly the CIA, but also the Pentagon, played such a key role in, you know, reinforcing, I would say, the influence of Israel, and in some ways was independent of that influence of the Israelis on U.S. policy toward Iran. So what I've done in the chapter is show how the CIA's interest in finding a substitute for the Soviet threat, which of course they knew even before the end, the official end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, was really coming to an end, and they were in a panic mode in 1987, 88, and 89, with regard to the consequences for the CIA for that collapse of the coming collapse of the Cold War, because they would stand to lose much of their congressional appropriations in a sort of sigh of relief response to that development. And so the CIA needed to have the equivalent of the Soviet threat, in effect, to try to keep as much as possible of their congressional appropriations after that happened. And of course the Defense Department was in the same situation, but I think for the purpose of showing that Iran was a threat in nuclear terms, the CIA was really the critical factor in this, and I go into some depth about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good times. All right, well, so here's one thing. I'll save that for when it comes up. Let's go back to 1989 then, where the scary old Ayatollah died and was replaced by a younger, somewhat nicer seeming Ayatollah, and also a brand new president, Rafsanjani, who's known to this day as a reformer. Now, I don't know what he ever reformed, but I think that means that Westerners sort of kind of like the guy, and he doesn't scare them the way Ahmadinejad scares them. That's what they really mean by reformer, right? And so here was an opportunity at the end of the Cold War, you know, when the whole deck is being reshuffled anyway, to go ahead and make peace with Iran and let bygones be bygones. After all, their revolution where they overthrew our sock puppet dictator was way back 10 years before. So enough time had passed. They could have gotten over their Cold War, and they could have had whatever nuclear deal they wanted if they wanted a nuclear deal with Iran then. What happened?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, this was the first really major historical opportunity for an end to the enmity that clearly did exist during the early 1980s, mid-1980s, between Iran and the United States. And it was an enmity that went both ways, for sure. And I point out that that there was a lot of political resistance in the United States to making up with Iran. But more than anything else, this sort of post-Cold War crisis, the approaching post-Cold War crisis, was the cutting-edge factor which prevented this possible opening between United States and Iran from taking place. And the context here, people need to understand, is that President-elect, not president-elect, but the new president, George H.W. Bush, in 1989, actually promised in his inaugural speech that he would reciprocate any help that Iran gave for the liberation of U.S. Prisoners held in Lebanon, people who were kidnapped by Shiite activists or militants, if you will, in the 1980s, and were being held in Lebanon. And the United States knew that Iran could, or believed the Iranians could, provide some assistance in this regard by influencing their allies, Shiite allies in Lebanon. And the Iranian, the new Iranian government of Rafsanjani did, in fact, offer to help in that regard. And we know for a fact that there were communications through intermediaries at the United Nations between Bush and the new Iranian government of Rafsanjani, and that that Rafsanjani did, in fact, assist, used his influence with his allies in Lebanon to begin to get these American hostages freed so that he could improve relations with the United States. And he believed that that would be the consequence of his doing so. So what happened? Well, the reason that there was not, in fact, reciprocation appears to be a combination of interests that were at play in 1990-91.
Wait, let me just interject here that I don't think you say this in the book, but these are some of the very same men, right? George H.W. Bush had been Reagan's vice president, and it was some of the very same people running his administration, of course. And these were the guys who had done arms for hostages, for getting hostages held in Lebanon released. And then, of course, the whole, funding the Contras in Nicaragua with the money and all of that, that became the same scandal. But it sounds like what you're telling me is this was sort of the open market version of that same thing, only instead of selling them missiles to use against Saddam, who we were also backing at the time from the earlier exchanges. In this case, they were saying, listen, let's go ahead and complete the You Get Our Hostages Released program that we've had going on here all these years, and go ahead and get that finished, and then we can have a real change of our relationship and the beginning of the end of the Cold War, reciprocal, this and that. That's what he meant, was we'll give you an opportunity to become friends again, at least to some limited degree, correct? And then you're saying, but what happened?
Well, you know, the analogy between the two situations, that is, the arms for hostages, not arms for hostages, the arms for Contra transaction in 1985, and the arms, the ability or the willingness to start to improve relations with Iran in return for the release of the hostages is not very precise for the following reason. Remember that Iran-Contra was really an Israeli initiative. It was the Israelis who were suggesting this to the Reagan administration and getting their friends to sort of work a deal that they believed would be in their interest. Because remember that the Israelis were interested in making up with the Iranian government in the belief that it was really beneath the surface there were these people who would be cooperative with Israel, who were not really hardcore Islamists. And so they were the ones behind that. And in 1991, the Israelis were still not hostile, not terribly hostile to Iran, but they were not the ones who were behind this. This was an entirely different set of interests. So you didn't have quite the same politics, I guess, is the point that I want to make here.
I guess, I'm just picking up on keywords, you know, Iran, hostages, Lebanon, and saying, well, the Reaganites had worked with them before, so why not again, you know?
The common point, however, you're right, there was a commonality, and that was that this represented a real sort of hard-nosed realism as opposed to a kind of extreme ideological policy toward Iran.
And, well, that's very kind of you to say, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what appeared to be possible, but here's what happened. The problem is, first of all, the people at the Pentagon realized that they had to have a war in order to avoid a collapse of their budget, and so we had the first Gulf War. And the result of that was that the United States now had a commanding military position in the Middle East, or at least the potential for that. And the neocons, particularly the person who was later to become the architect of the Iraq War, Wolfowitz, and his staff were pushing the idea that this meant that the United States was now in an entirely new power position in the Middle East, and they didn't need to have good relations with Iran. And so they were the ones who were basically saying, don't do this. Don't get into a posture of a sort of moderation towards Iran. And at the same time, it was very important that Robert Gates, who was just getting back to the CIA as the new director in late 1991, had this interest in sort of using the imagined threat of an Iran getting nuclear weapons as the key to sort of rebuilding a constituency in Congress for continuing very high levels, sort of Cold War levels of congressional appropriations for the CIA. Mm-hmm. And those two interests, you know, basically worked together to essentially veto the initiative that the White House had planned to carry out to reciprocate the Iranians' help in getting U.S. hostages out of Lebanon.
All right, now, it's funny because I actually remember, I was very young at the time, but I remember, you know, one of these probably PBS news shows my dad was watching or something like that, where the eggheads are saying, yes, you know, the rogue states and proliferation of long-range missile technology and nuclear technology will certainly be the problem of the coming generation. And they really were thinking ahead. I mean, I'm thinking back to, say, 91, 92, something like that. They were really on the ball. This is the message, that it's a dangerous world out there, USSR or not.
This is one of the great manipulations of public opinion in the history of the Cold War and post-Cold War. It goes along with, of course, the recreation of political support for the use of military force by the United States through the first Gulf War, which is an immensely popular war. So those two incredibly successful manipulations took place during the same time frame. It was quite a major shift that took place sort of below the surface without people understanding it.
Mm. Yeah, without the masses thought, well, where's our peace dividend? And
exactly.
That was where it went. They couldn't see it. All right, now, so...
And there was, believe me, at the CIA, there was a great deal of thought given to what they had to do to try to create a shift in political consciousness towards the CIA. You know, what do we have to do to get people to think? Well, we've got to have a big CIA budget, and they realized that it was sort of a WMD threat from regional powers. That was the ticket, and of course, Iran was the poster child the poster country, if you will, for that theme.
Mm-hmm. And I'll encourage people to really look at this book, Manufactured Crisis, for reference after reference after reference. This is not a construction of Gareth Porter. This is Gareth Porter with the ultimate in detail of these people announcing exactly what their intentions are, and in very cynical fashion and whatever. You know, read it yourself and weep for real. I highly suggest you look at it. It's all there in their own words. And in fact, before we get on to the Clinton years, and we're going to go over time anyway, I hope it's okay with you. I got to ask you about what you say about CENTCOM here, the central command responsible for, you know, the Middle East and Asia and all that, all the way to India, at least. Their plan in the Cold War years was centered around the idea of keeping the Soviets out of Iran, back when Iran belonged to us and the Soviets were a threat. So then Iran had ceased belonging to us a decade before, and the Soviet Union was falling apart. And so over at CENTCOM, they decided to draw up a new reason for existing. And, you know, stop me. I don't want to sound too conspiratorial or put words in your mouth that you didn't say or anything like that. I'm the only one making the connections here that you don't make in the book. But I got to ask for your comment on this, where in 1990, they say Norman Schwarzkopf cited Iraq as the most plausible enemy for a permanent war plan, not necessarily to attack right now or anything like that, but to build a war plan around, a reason for CENTCOM's existence, around the theory that Iraq is someone that we might need to fight, and specifically because we might need to keep them out of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And this was their plan that they wrote up or began writing up or something, you tell me, in 1989, and then it was just a year later, and again, this is not in the book, I'm going off my own separate references here, the April Glaspie memo, and of course all the controversy about whether James Baker, in effect, gave the green light, or maybe waved the red flag at Saddam Hussein's bull and baited him into invading Kuwait so that they had an excuse to put their troops in Saudi Arabia and establish that heightened military presence that you just talked about Wolfowitz referring to there, and that they had their excuse. And I mean, is it too obvious and not that simple, or what am I getting wrong here, other than that, yeah, this was their plan, was to start a war?
Well, it's always a bit more complex, because there are enabling factors. There's no question about that. I mean, Saddam played into the interests of the people you're talking about and made it easy for them. But having said that, I mean, you know, absolutely, there's no doubt about it that the war that was fought in 1991, the first Gulf War, was a war, not just a war of choice, but it was a war that was chosen by the interests that were going to stand to gain the most from it, which are the Army, the Air Force, and CENTCOM. I mean, it was the people who needed to have a rationale for future congressional appropriations at Cold War levels, or as close as possible to Cold War levels, that required a new war plan. And as you point out, when the new CENTCOM commander came into office, he looked at the old war plan, which had the Soviet Union invading Iran, and he points out in his memoirs, look, that nobody took that seriously. Really, everybody knew that was ridiculous. It was always simply a way of justifying a U.S. military presence in the Middle East of some sort, nothing more than that. And so he could see that they needed a new one because the Cold War was ending. There was a very strong interest in putting forward a new war plan. So that's why that happened. And having that new war plan obviously was a precondition for the war that took place in 1991. So I think it all constitutes very strong evidence that war was nothing more than taking advantage of an opportunity which presented itself in order to ensure that the national security state and particularly the military and its
industrial allies would go on to enjoy power, prestige, and lots of resources for the next 20 years.
Hmm. Well, and again, I'm sorry to stay off the exact topic of the subject matter of the book here, but I believe I just learned recently, was it from Barry Lando? Do you know, have you ever heard that the Americans were actually encouraging the Saudis and the Kuwaitis to keep overproducing and keep the prices low and to deliberately snub Saddam Hussein and refuse to show up at their meetings and all that? Because that was what the fight with Kuwait was about. He was trying to pay them back.
I'll be honest, I've not actually seen that documentation, but I do know that there are indications, there is evidence that Prime Minister Thatcher was absolutely doing that in her contacts with the Kuwaitis specifically. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's every reason to believe that Thatcher was communicating directly with the Bush, senior Bush administration officials. So I have no doubt that there is truth in that report.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, one of the big lies of that invasion, it wasn't just the incubators, which is the thing that people remember the most because it's just so galling that they would lie to us about murdered babies in order to start a war. Not that it was the first time, but it really bothers people when they find out what a lie that was. But one of the other major lies, of course, was the other part of this war plan, right, that it's keeping Saddam out of Saudi. And that was their threat, that Saddam was just going to keep rolling south. And everybody knows now that the Russians released the satellite pictures. The Canadian news service, I believe, CBC, got the satellite pictures of the empty desert where Saddam's tank divisions supposedly were preparing to invade Saudi Arabia. And I actually know a guy who was in the Air Force at the time looking at satellite pictures of the empty desert while on TV they were proclaiming that they weren't sure if they could get enough planes there in time to keep Saddam from rolling his tank divisions down and sacking Riyadh.
Every war the United States fights, as you know better than hardly almost anyone, Scott, has had an intelligence, false intelligence basis. There's been some intelligence claim that turns out to be untrue, and no doubt about it, this was the false intelligence that helped to make possible the entry into war in Kuwait.
Yeah. All right. So now, hope and change. 1993, Bill Clinton comes to town, and those mean old arrogant Republicans are gone. And the soft, friendly Vietnam beatnik generation guys come in, and they decided that they would be friendly with the Iranians, because why not, right?
Well, they should have, but as we now know, of course, it was exactly the opposite, that Bill Clinton farmed out his Middle East policy to the Israelis, making a political decision early in his campaign, apparently, by hiring Martin Indyk as his Middle East advisor. And as I show in the book, the first thing that happens is that Indyk convinces him that he must follow precisely what the Israeli government wants him to do, which is to essentially rely on a strong Israel as the basis for his peace policy in the Middle East. And that, of course, then translates into hostility toward Iran, and indeed considering Iran to be an outlaw state, which is what his new administration immediately declares within weeks of his being inaugurated. And as part of that, then, you know, he essentially follows a policy that regards Iran as a officially as a nuclear weapons threat, and that becomes an established policy, which I think very clearly has a profound impact on the way the intelligence community deals with that issue. And you know, one of the best things about my book is that it documents the way in which U.S. intelligence was immediately distorted by the policy of the administration, the Clinton administration, and intelligence analysts were expected to come up with evidence to support the idea that Iran was a nuclear weapons threat. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened almost immediately.
All right, now, I'm sorry that I got to stop you there and rewind a second, and this is going to be the subject of the next interview, because it's really in the next chapter about the Israeli politics behind all of this. But you just mentioned it, and it bears repeating, because even though I just finished reading this, hearing you say it out loud, it's almost unbelievable just in how sad it is. Not that a politician wouldn't come up with this as his plan, but when you say that Yitzhak Rabin, the reason that he decided that he needed to be such a hawk on Iran and he needed to drum up this so-called threat of an Iranian nuclear program, which then translated pretty much directly into the Clinton administration's stance, was because he thought he needed to have that tough guy, right-wing, hawkish stance on Iran or somebody while he was trying to negotiate peace for the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip before somebody shot him.
That's exactly right. I mean, his
motive...
That
is just absolutely tragic.
Right. It is tragic. It's emblematic, I think, of the broader historical pattern in Israeli policy, whereby Iran's a bogeyman, which fulfills multiple functions for the Israeli government, whether it's Labor or Likud. It provides a convenient sort of whipping boy or bogeyman for the Israeli government to point to, both on the Palestinian issue as well as for ensuring that the United States doesn't stray from its very close sort of strategic relationship with Israel, relying on Israel as the main ally in the Middle East, which is of course a fundamental interests of every Israeli government. So
where Netanyahu uses Iran as an excuse for everyone to look away from what he's doing wrong in Palestine, Rabin wanted to use it to get everybody to look away from his chance he thought he wanted to take there to do the right thing and give up the West Bank.
Right. I mean, I think that is the interesting pattern that we see, regardless of whether the policy was to negotiate with the PLO or to try to crush the Palestinians, which of course is the Likud approach. The idea was to cite the threat from Iran in either case.
Man, ain't that something. All right, so now Clinton hires Martin Indyk to be his point man for all things Middle East policy, and he came up with this policy of, instead of making peace with Iraq and Iran, which both used to be friends, instead of even offshore balancing, they decided instead on this policy of dual containment. What's the big deal? What's the big difference?
Well, the idea of dual containment, the concept of dual containment, was really a mechanism by which Indyk could get the United States to take as hard a line toward Iran as it was already taking toward Iraq. It was a rather clever formula for accomplishing that objective. And what it meant was, essentially, he wanted the United States to adopt the same kind of economic sanctions against Iran that had already been adopted towards Iraq. And, of course, the intention would be to do the same thing, to weaken the fabric of society, to basically have the kind of suffering take place in Iran that took place in Iraq, that would serve the broader interests of Israel. And that was certainly one of the more ingenious policy ideas that came out of the Martin Indyk school.
Yeah, except for what a bad idea it was. I mean, I guess it accomplished what he thought it would accomplish for his ends, but for the American national interest,
But bearing in mind, of course, that Martin Indyk started as the media advisor to the Yitzhak Shamir Likud government the Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, and he had no Middle East expertise. He had no claim to be an expert on Middle East policy. All he had going for him was that he had been a propagandist for Shamir, and then, you know, became the founder of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which, of course, is well known as a think tank to advance the interests of Israel and Washington.
Right, and which is always cited on Syria issues, Iran issues, and they say, oh, you know, the Washington Institute, where they're smart over there or whatever. But what they're talking about is a group that was literally created by AIPAC to serve their point of view.
Absolutely. This is nothing more than a very sophisticated propaganda outfit. That was the whole purpose, to mask to whatever degree was possible the propaganda function of the organization by casting it as a sort of quasi academic kind of outfit, doing research which is more high toned rather than openly propagandistic.
Right. Well, and you know what though, even from the Likudnik's point of view, it doesn't seem that brilliant to me, because it still all just ends up backfiring. Like we talked about the other day, all the pressure on China to prevent them from cooperating with the Iranians just drove their program underground and really committed them to the principle that they better master their own fuel cycle and uranium enrichment, because if they have to go to the world market, the Americans are going to stop them from pursuing their rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so they end up buying junk from AQ Khan, which very well could have included weapons blueprints if they'd been interested in such things. And they develop their experiments and whatever else they're doing in secret instead of under the watchful eye of the IAEA. And then, you know, as I gather in this chapter here, their pressure on Boris Yeltsin and the Russians to stop helping with the Bushehr reactor, ultimately it didn't work, but it led to, you know, consequences right there as far as, you know, remaining basically a wedge issue to prevent reconciliation on any other thing.
Well, I agree with you, Scott, but I think, in fact, the impact of Israeli policy, particularly, I mean, both Labor and Likud, you can't really distinguish between them in terms of how bad the policy was, is even much worse than what you've suggested, because, in fact, in the 1990s, the Iranians were perfectly willing to have a reasonably live and let live policy toward Israel, even though they were not very keen on the negotiations between the Israelis and the PLO, primarily because they needed to appeal, I think, to the Islamic a man on the street to show that they were pro-Palestinian. I mean, they were afraid that that they would be in worse shape in the Arab world if they didn't have a very strong policy of support for the Palestinian rights. But they were definitely ready to reach an accommodation with Israel, and it was the Israelis who, in the end, decided to follow a policy of hostility toward Iran, to make them the bogeyman, and to threaten to carry out strikes against this fictional, weapons program. I mean, basically to carry out strikes against any nuclear program in Iran, which resulted in the Iranians going much farther in regard to ballistic missiles than they would have otherwise.
Yeah, none of this makes any sense from their interest point of view. They just it just gets worse and worse. And then now here's where we get back to the American national interest here, and we're already over time. I know I got to let you go, but you make sure and mention this in your chapter there about how in the 1990s the political pressure to, you know, hawk it up about Iran for this, that, or the other thing was such that, and you don't really focus on this that much, but you certainly draw the examples out where the government really failed to do their job when it came to investigating and or, you know, in any way protecting the American people from the Al-Qaeda threat, because they were so hell-bent on blaming Hezbollah for everything. I didn't even realize they had originally tried to blame the first World Trade Center bombing on Hezbollah. And then, of course, as you have famously documented in the past, they quite falsely blamed Hezbollah for the attacks in Buenos Aires in 92 and 94, and then for the Khobar Towers attack in 1996, which was...
The degree to which there was the hostility toward Iran permeated the CIA's...
Wait, I didn't mean to say, I didn't mean to imply that I thought that Al-Qaeda did Buenos Aires, but I just meant that certainly the First World Trade Center, the Blind Sheikh, and the Khobar Towers, I mean, these are attacks against Americans by the budding Al-Qaeda movement that for political reasons, our federal police and national government leadership blamed on Israel's enemies instead.
And this is another case, a really clear-cut example of how the broad policy orientation of the administration, in this case the Clinton administration, basically shapes to a great extent the orientation of the intelligence agencies, both in this case, I mean, we'll call it the FBI intelligence, although it's not intelligence, but agencies working on terrorism towards the cases that they're asked to look at. Because they inevitably reflected the overt hostility toward Iran that the Clinton administration just talked about constantly.
All right, well, that's a good place to stop. Well, there really is no good place to stop, but that's as good as any. Tomorrow, when we catch up, we'll be starting off with more of the politics inside Israel about ginning up this threat in the 1990s and through the 2000s as well, as we continue with our interview series with Gareth Porter about his great new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Thanks very much, Gareth. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Talk to you tomorrow.